Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with author Steve Lopez. His story of destitute musician Nathaniel Ayers is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia. Susan Lewis considers the Delaware Art Museum a museum of stories with its own tale to tell. Jason Pfeiffer explores how the skills and traditions of folk art are being passed on through apprenticeships. And David Patrick Stearns takes us to the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Beethoven's Fidelio. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In 2005, on a busy street corner in downtown L.A., former Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Steve Lopez heard a beautiful melody being drawn from a battered violin by a shabbily dressed homeless man. Nathaniel Ayers had once been a promising musician, studying bass at Juilliard. Now destitute and suffering with mental illness, he was living on the streets. What started off as a series of columns for the L.A. Times turned into a mission for Lopez, and he has, over the past 3 years, formed a close friendship with Ayers that has taken the musician off the streets and into a more stable existence. Steve Lopez tells that story in his book, The Soloist, which is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia. We spoke with him earlier this year.
Downtown Los Angeles is a very busy place. It's thousands of people walking to and from work, and he did not appear to be playing for money. He didn't have the violin case open. He didn't have a hat out. He was just playing to play music. And I said, well, why do you pick this particular spot? And he pointed across the street and he said, there's the Beethoven statue. I play here for inspiration. And so then I knew I might have something, but it took several visits to figure out what this guy's story was. And with each visit, he warmed up to me a little more, and I was able to tug the story out of him. And the big break comes when he's scratching names on the sidewalk, and I ask him, who's Betty and Albert and Tom and, Rebecca, and he said, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I said, Nathaniel, you went to the Juilliard School for the Performing Arts? He said, oh, yeah, that was a while back. He said it quite nonchalantly, like it's no big deal to go to Juilliard. And I'm thinking, okay, we've got an African-American man, homeless, playing a violin, missing two strings, went to Juilliard. I think I've got a column.
Nathaniel, at this point, wouldn't have appeared to have been a very, shall we say, reliable source. How did you go about verifying this story?
Well, you know, I would ask Nathaniel on the street there, who can I talk to get the backstory on this? And how did you train in Cleveland? How did you become a musician? And he said, well, you know, I grew up it was kind of a tough neighborhood. His mother had a beauty salon. His dad was out of the picture. Mom had music on in the beauty salon. And Nathaniel just took to the music. He'd go there after school. The ladies are all having their hair done. And Nathaniel's enjoying the music. And his mother says, maybe you should take piano lessons. So he does a couple years of that and then goes to junior high band. And that's, you know, we're talking 60s when public schools in America had extensive arts programs. It was considered part of a well-rounded education and everybody was handed an instrument. And the arts were big. It was before we got into the three R's and not much else. So he had a natural thing for it, and his junior high band teacher had him playing several instruments, but nobody could play the bass. And Nathaniel was a strong kid, and they needed a rhythm section, and Nathaniel was pushed in the corner with the bass and became so good on it in such a hurry that his teacher, Mr. Moon, said, I can't help you. You're going to have to go to see this guy in the Cleveland Symphony. His name is Harry Barnoff. He's been in the orchestra forever, and he teaches some of my better students. And that became his tutor. So I'm on the street in downtown L.A., and I said, Nathaniel, who influenced you? And he said, oh, you can call Mr. Harry Barnoff in Cleveland. And I said, well, how do I get hold of him? And with an index finger, thin air, writes out his phone number. And I scribble it in my notebook, and I said, are you still in contact with him? He said, nope, I haven't talked to him in decades. So I'm calling the number thinking it can't be any good. And somebody picks up on the other end and says, Barnoff residence.
Wow.
So Harry Barnoff told me that Harry was in tears when I told him that his former student was playing a two-string violin in downtown Los Angeles living out of a shopping cart. And he said, that was one of the most promising students I ever had, and my heart is broken hearing this. He was such a great kid, And it was so tragic to see his crash.
People, we love a great story about redemption. And this really is just such a story, is it not?
This is, I think it's a story about second chances and human connections and the power of art and music. It has saved him. In his third year at Juilliard, he starts getting very confused and having trouble focus. And when you go through the transcripts, if he's having to sit in a classroom and study the history of music literature, his grades are falling. If he's in performance with the orchestra, he's getting A's. And the teacher comments are, promising young talent, renew his scholarship, unlimited potential. Nobody knew that he was losing his mind. And Juilliard at the time, as far as I can gather, was not a welcoming place. And there was nobody there to pick up on little emotional problems or psychological problems. And there was one teacher there, a bass teacher by the name of Gary Carr, who went on to be the rare person with a solo career as a bassist, who saw that Nathaniel was having problems. And he told his the administration, they said, no, he's just a troublemaker. And he said, no, he is losing his mind, which indeed he was. So he crashes, goes home to Cleveland. He's in and out of his mother's house. He's on the streets. He realizes he can't lug a bass around in a shopping cart. He saves up money working at Wendy's and shoveling snow, walks 15 miles, buys a violin, and has been trying to teach himself other instruments all these years later. So I meet him, and he's down and out. But, you know, this serendipitous encounter leads to what has been a really deep and meaningful three-year odyssey and one of the, you know, the most meaningful relationships and friendships in my life.
Steve Lopez. His book, The Soloist, documenting his relationship with the destitute musician Nathaniel Ayers, is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Art often tells some kind of story, but some art more directly connects with the narrative. In 1912, the work of American illustrator Howard Pyle became the nucleus of what is now the Delaware Art Museum. Since then, the museum has continued to build upon the theme of storytelling, even as its collection has sprouted in different directions. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the continuing story of the museum itself.
On the lower level of the Delaware Art Museum, a child, or even an adult, can create an illustrated story on a computer screen, step by step. First, you pick a genre, comedy, for example. Then you choose from backgrounds which might look familiar to art students or anyone who's been wandering around the museum.
These are all settings from works in our collection.
Museum Director of Education Courtney Waring rattles off some of the possibilities.
We've got works by Howard Pyle, Edward Hopper, John Sloan, Frederick Edwin Church, and you select one.
In this computer game, the characters and even the props are also all images from the museum's collections. After making the visual selections, you can write a story, even with a strange cast of characters in a rather unusual setting, as in this sample story.
A friendly old hobo was eating his delicious baked beans when all of a sudden an armored knight seated atop a majestic horse and a cowboy on a bucking bronco stumbled their way onto the hobo's seat.
This is one of the ways the Delaware Art Museum brings its collection to life. And storytelling through art goes back to the beginning of the museum's own story. Once upon a time, actually in the early days of the 20th century, reading was on the rise, as technology had created more leisure time and electric light by which to read. Books and magazines were often illustrated with original paintings and graphic works. Wilmington native Howard Pyle was a leading illustrator and the first to actually teach illustration. Then, in 1911, Pyle died suddenly at the age of 58. His friends and students banded together to protect and preserve his works. They formed the Wilmington Society for the Fine Arts.
At that point, it was almost entirely his art.
Delaware Art Museum Executive Director Danielle Rice says the collection expanded.
It eventually grew to include the art of his students as well as a library full of illustrated books and archives, his students' notes, for example.
His students included Jesse Wilcox Smith, N.C. Wyeth, and Frank Schoonover, all who lived and worked in the Brandywine Valley. Although illustrations were in demand commercially, Delaware's curator of collections and exhibitions, Mary Holohan, says they were not particularly valued as fine art.
Often the artists themselves really didn't go to any great lengths to preserve the work, or it was thrown out by the art editing department.
That, she says, is changing.
From the point of view of the general public and also scholarship. And I think as more illustration is seen, as can be seen here, more and more people will come to realize that it is as valid an art form as what we traditionally consider fine art.
But illustration was not to be the only focus of the museum. In the 1930s, as the country struggled to emerge from the Great Depression, the Wilmington Society of the Fine Arts found itself faced with a large gift and an even bigger challenge. The Bancroft family would donate the sizable Samuel Bancroft collection of pre-Raphaelite art, along with a large tract of land, but, says Danielle Rice, there was a condition.
The requirement was that we build a building. In fact, it was Frank Schoonover, an artist who had been a student of Howard Pyle, who was very instrumental in leading the charge to raise the money to build the building, which is the brick building with the arches that is still part of the museum complex.
The newly named Delaware Art Center opened in 1938 with an expanded focus. The 19th century pre-Raphaelite artists gave themselves that name because they were looking back in time before the great Renaissance master Raphael, says Mary Hollihan.
They were looking back really toward the late Middle Ages, both for their techniques and for their subject matter, and for what they saw really as their personal virtue, looking at almost a monastic type of morality.
The art, which includes paintings, drawings, prints, decorative arts like stained glass, furniture, and jewelry, also has a literary link.
A number of the pre-Raphaelite artists were illustrators themselves. They were interested in really literary art of all kinds, both ancient, biblical, poetry by Shelley, Tennyson, Keats, and literature of their own time. Dante Gabriel Rossetti did some paintings which were, you might say, actually illustrations of his own poetry.
As the years went by, the museum also increased its holdings of 19th and 20th century artists like Winslow Homer, Edward Hopper, and Andrew Wyeth. In the 1960s, the museum, says Rice, took another giant leap forward.
In 1960, the curator of the museum at the time was working on an exhibition, and he came to know the widow of one of these artists.
The artist, John Sloan, says Mary Hollihan, was known as one of the Ashcan artists.
Sloan and his group originally got that moniker, so to speak, because they were painting works of art not in the refined academic tradition, you know, of genteel interiors, but they were out on the street actually painting what they were seeing there, which often at that time period was pretty grainy and gritty.
Sloan's widow, Helen Farr Sloan, became a dedicated supporter of the museum, even moving to Wilmington in her later years and donating over 3,000 paintings, prints, and drawings by her husband, giving the museum yet another distinctive strength. The museum has continued to grow inside and out, adding an education wing in 1959, an auditorium in 1987, and undergoing more renovation in 2003. As it's filled out its core collection of American art and illustration with 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st century art, a sculpture garden, and other works, it's taken community requests into consideration about art and even landscaping, says Danielle Rice.
I was approached by a group of women who expressed their interest in having a labyrinth in the museum's sculpture garden. Labyrinth is a single circular path into the middle, and then you walk out. And through absolute volunteer effort, the labyrinth came to be, and it's become one of the most popular places in the sculpture garden right now.
In the end, the Delaware Art Museum strives to inspire creativity in all ages and to be more than a place to just look at art. Last year, a contest challenged people to make up short audio stories prompted by objects in its collection. Now, labels identify those works of art about which the winning stories were made, and visitors can listen to them on iPods as part of the museum experience. Danielle Rice calls it a museum about stories. And the Delaware Art Museum's own story goes on, with a beautiful setting, passionate characters, and unexpected twists and turns that all seem connected in the end, or at least the end of this chapter.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Delaware Art Museum is now hosting a show of photographs by Gordon Parks, whose images documented social issues during the civil rights era for Life magazine. Bear Witness, Photographs by Gordon Parks, runs through January 4th. With the rapid pace of 21st century life, aspects of traditional arts and crafts run the risk of being lost. The nuances and distinct styles of folk art, arts and crafts that are an outgrowth of everyday life, aren't taught in art schools and conservatories. As older ways of life fade away, so too do hands-on skills and customs. But one way these traditions are passed on is through apprenticeships. And as WRTI's Jason Pipe reports, the teaching and learning is happening throughout the country, both formally and informally.
The idea of an apprenticeship may bring to mind Donald Trump's television show, The Apprentice. But this method of passing on techniques and knowledge was around well before television of any kind. Apprenticeship systems date back centuries. For many years, it was the principal means by which people learned trades, tailors, shoemakers, butchers, and painters. Entering into an agreement with a master, young apprentices would gain vocational skills in exchange for labor, sometimes committing to work for little or no pay until the age of 21. With the proliferation of schools, technology, and labor laws, apprenticeships are less common today, though not unheard of. Many electricians and sheet metal workers, for example, go through a formal apprenticeship process. And the intensive learning and teaching model has a special role in the world of folk art. Barry Berge is the Director of Folk and Traditional Arts at the National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA.
It's an age-old process, really, of one-on-one teaching and mentoring, usually through oral tradition and demonstration. It certainly isn't unique to folk arts, but it's very appropriate to folk and traditional arts.
Appropriate, because the techniques and skills involved with many folk and traditional arts are very hands-on and detail-oriented. Teaching and learning traditions like glass blowing, banjo making, cultural dances, quilting, basket weaving, and pottery require a great deal of individual attention. Though apprenticeships have been taking place informally for a long time, the NEA has used the apprenticeship model, bringing together a master artist and an apprentice in a formal way since 1983. Barry Berge explains the NEA does this by administering grants through state programs to master artists.
The problem for many traditional artists, at least, is that they may have to earn their living through another career. So the apprenticeship allows them the time and supports their time, I would say not as generously sometimes as we would like, to do that teaching. So we're in effect making it worth their while to teach.
And more often than not, experienced and accomplished folk artists are eager to teach and pass on what they know. Deborah Kodish, director and founder of the Philadelphia Folklore Project, which often helps masters and apprentices apply for government support, says this exchange is taken very seriously.
Someone who has spent their life feeling like they're a custodian of a tradition and they feel responsible to a community for keeping this legacy available, they're looking for somebody who's going to take that on after them. So this has been important because that's not a government program. That's a government program recognizing that this is a way that these forms have really been kept going.
In many cases, artistic traditions have been passed along through one-on-one relationships without giving a thought to whether or not it was technically an apprenticeship. Philadelphia Folklore Project Associate Director Jermaine Ingram studied and performed for nearly 20 years with the late LaVon Robinson, an internationally acclaimed tap dance artist and teacher. Ingram says during that time, they never called their relationship an apprenticeship.
He was my friend, he was my teacher, he was my mentor.
But Ingram recognizes that what they had was essentially an apprenticeship. She would meet with Robinson every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. to learn his Philly style of tap dance. Ingram says her strong commitment to the art form resulted.
These mentoring apprenticeship relationships, I mean, if they are truly that, I mean, I think we've sort of watered down words so much that, you know, what people call mentoring these days is hard for me to recognize as such.
Terrence Cameron, who lives in West Philadelphia, is a master in the art of steel drum making. For decades, he worked from the basement of his home, making and repairing the Caribbean-style musical instrument, traditionally created from 55-gallon steel oil drums.
And each one is a different note. We have like octaves.
Raised in Trinidad, Cameron says he was first exposed to the sound of the steel drum as a young boy, music that immediately captivated him, though he initially had to hide his love of steel drums from his parents.
It had a bad stigma to it. I think the people, the street gangs, they created the steel drum. You know, your parents didn't want you to be associated with a steel drum.
As a teenager, Terrence Cameron began an informal apprenticeship with Stanley Warner, one of the first great masters of steel drum making, traveling with Warner around Trinidad to make and play drums. For nearly 50 years, Cameron continued crafting and repairing drums, up until a few years ago when arthritis set in. Along the way, Cameron did what many former apprentices do. He took on apprentices of his own. With perspective from both sides of apprenticeship, Cameron notes there's a key component, time.
I mean, you can't learn to make a steel drum in a week or two or a month. It takes years and years and years of, you know, trial and error.
Every apprenticeship looks different. Some pairs might meet once a week, others every few days, and for someone like Vera Nakonechny, maybe every day. Nakonechny, who emigrated to the U.S. when she was a teenager, specializes in Ukrainian embroidery. On two occasions, she brought over an expert on the traditional art form from Ukraine to live with her and her family in Philadelphia for months at a time. Nakonechny says there are about 200 different stitches and more than 20 different techniques associated with traditional Ukrainian embroidery.
I think I master about 12 to 15. There's a lot more to learn.
Nakonechny is passionate about learning and teaching these different embroidery techniques of her culture, because while Ukraine was under the Soviet regime, these traditions were nearly lost. The communist government discouraged many folk art practices. When Ukraine opened up again in the early 90s, Nakonechny began traveling to her homeland on a yearly basis to conduct archival research about Ukrainian folk art traditions and help keep them alive. Nakonechny says her main goal is to not only learn for herself, but also pass that knowledge on to newer generations, and one-on-one apprenticeships help to do that well. But she says in contrast to the casual learning that might happen in a classroom or workshop setting, it's crucial that apprentices also have deep passion for the art form.
An apprenticeship is that person really wants to learn and really wants to expand the knowledge. There is a hunger of doing it and knowing and refining techniques.
In an age with so much transience and technology offering endless entertainment options, it's arguably more difficult in the 21st century to structure lives into intimate, time-intensive apprenticeships. Then again, mobility and technology might be the very things that help sustain folk ways, exposing the traditions to a wider audience. Just as there are those who are eager to share their knowledge of arts and crafts, it's clear there are many around who are hungry to learn and carry on these same traditions.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. While many of Beethoven's masterpieces demand respect, devotion, and even subjugation, his only opera, Fidelio, asks for help. That's one reason the piece has been absent from the Opera Company of Philadelphia seasons for the past 19 years. In the works for 3 years, a $2 million production now at the Academy of Music was contingent not on finding the right singers, but solutions to theatrical problems. Addressing that, painter and sculptor June Kaniko transplants the story of a woman rescuing her long-imprisoned husband into a high-style netherworld of imagery and symbolism, as the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns explained to us just before the production opened 2 weeks ago.
It's funny, like, it's not turquoise and it's not royal, and even the dye...
The question you don't hear backstage at the new production of Fidelio is why? Any answer is likely to be evasive or provisional from June Kaneko, the Japan-born, Omaha-based artist whose work is now exhibited at the Lux Gallery in Philadelphia and all along Park Avenue in New York City. On Tuesday, at an Academy of Music dressing room, costumer Richard St. Clair was getting the right shade of blue on the correct sleeve of an asymmetrically colored dotted outfit that soprano Eileen Perez will wear in the role of Marcelina.
I don't know. I don't think there is no answer about this is right or wrong. It's just purely intuitive taste, and, you know, you just say, yeah, that's it.
Kaneko explains why. Well, sort of.
Oh, this is great, but you say, well, maybe it's a different taste, you know.
You have to ask how fabrics could possibly change the way soprano Perez plays the straightforward role of a jailer's daughter. but it does.
For me, the costumes always dictate and inform the character on stage. Everything is very clean, and I think it informs my character a lot, and I'm enjoying, I can't wait to see the real shoes and to feel what they're going to be like on the rake and on the stage.
Virtually nothing about Beethoven or his music would suggest that such attention to exteriors would matter. His music is often the antithesis of sensuality, and with Fidelio, Beethoven struggled over many years, as deeply as he believed in the opera's humanitarian ideals. Giving them faces and names and putting them into a plot wasn't something his muse always accommodated. Clearly, Beethoven was in alien territory. Though his compositional process was always full of false starts and revisions, Beethoven seemed not to know when the start in Fidelio was a false one until it was all finished and orchestrated. That's one explanation why he wrote four overtures, two of which are rambling and full of musical blind alleys. If there's one thing that Beethoven does indisputably well in this opera, it's to convey the utter hopelessness of a political prisoner. He has been virtually buried alive in the deepest recesses of the prison, seen only by jailers who are the most obedient, ask the fewest questions, and can cope with feeding him less and less every day. Opera Company of Philadelphia music director Corrado Roveras talks about how Beethoven's notes and orchestration take one's ears to such an almost unimaginably bleak place.
Step by step, you go dark and dark, and you go in the prison, and you change completely in the orchestration, and you change, and so you have to find another sound, another approach, where the orchestration, you have this darkness with these waves in the bass section with the contrabassoon, and you think that you're hopeless.
The less Fidelio has to do with a particular time and place, since its story could happen anywhere, anytime that political prisoners are held without fair trial, the more likely its timeless message will float to the surface. June Kaneko's visual language, however, isn't an obvious choice for the opera. It's colorful, ebullient. His dumpling-shaped sculptures on Park Avenue aren't exactly menacing. Nonetheless, his responses to the darker parts of Fidelio most excite Opera Company of Philadelphia's artistic director, Robert Driver.
This was something that June came up with that I just feel captures how he internalized the music here. We'll have this huge screen in front, you know, instead of a curtain, during the second act, introduction to the second act. But, for example, you just see this grid work, the prison symbol, and you see these dots of color. And the first dot is a red one. And then the dots descend like this, and it becomes very colorful. And then that goes into total darkness.
The production may well be seen outside Philadelphia. Kaneko's Madame Butterfly has been produced in several cities so far, and impresarios from many opera companies will be in Philadelphia for Fidelio. Regardless of its success, Kaneko claims to have no interest in following in the footsteps of painter David Hockney by pursuing a second career in opera design. Even the applause, he says, feels a bit awkward. But only a bit.
But it's something, though. Here, 2,500 seat, that many people come. And it's a really interesting condensed energy.
Sounds to me like the beginning of a theater addiction.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Fidelio in tomorrow's paper. All of the excerpts in that piece come from a Deutsche Grammophon recording of the Vienna State Opera conducted by Leonard Bernstein. The final two performances of the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Fidelio are tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 and on Friday at 8. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Great. Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.